This week's podcast is brought to you by Joe's Cafe. They are our sponsor because he made me breakfast this morning. Well, he bought the milk. All right, that's so this week we have as a guest Robert W. Ross. How are you doing, Robert?
Doing well. All things considered for 2020, that means I'm not on fire at the moment.
Right, at the moment. May happen at some point during the year.
At any point during the day, yeah.
Randomly combust.
That's awesome. And for our knights, that's what we call our followers, if you remember, our good friend Nick, the narrator, is featured in your book. So we're super excited to finally tie the worlds together from author to narrator to us.
Awesome. So you guys did a podcast with Nick already?
Yeah, we did one. Yeah. How long ago is that, Johnny? Maybe 2 months ago, 3 months ago?
Yeah, 2 months.
If I wish I had known, I would have seeded you with embarrassing questions for him.
Well, he led us to you, actually. I don't know if you knew this. We said, Nick, do you have any shameless plugs for us? And he said, oh, check out my writing friend and read his book. And so I downloaded it and finished it maybe a month after we interviewed Nick. You know, all I needed was his go-ahead for me to do it. And then I left you a review, 5 stars on Audible. So,
it's you know. Very nice review. Yeah. Yes. And you, it was just the Paradigm series, not the Sentinels one, just the or have you done both now?
Correct. Just Trinity's Children.
Got it.
I haven't done any of the other work.
We actually met on a different series that I'm now, the 6th book just went to him this week.
Oh, really?
So, Paradigm is actually a new collaboration, in coordination with Podium Audio. And that was, that one went to market, was released in August, obviously. And that's probably which one he was talking about. But yeah, he and I have been working together for like 6 years now. Started off with my first fantasy series and then moved into the sci-fi series, which is the one you just referenced.
So help me out. Paradigm is the fantasy series, correct?
No, Paradigm 2045 is sci-fi, yeah.
Okay, and it's the Trinity's Children.
Trinity's Children is the first book of 3. The second one is Humanity's Promise. That's the cover that you see there. The last one is Omandi's Demon.
Okay.
And that's the third book in that series.
Very nice. Okay, cool. That's what I thought.
But I just love how I was going to plug. Nick plugged it to us by saying, if you want to hear me doing a woman Russian accent, check this out. And I was like, done. You sold me.
Absolutely. Yeah, and he does it real well. I mean, he makes me like I could change teams for that sound.
Well, and he
does good.
He cracked me up because he's, you know, we kind of said, all right, do some voices for us. And he was like, if you want to hear voices, check out my next book, because they stretched my limits on this one.
Yeah, in the Sentinel series, once we started and became friends, and in addition to colleagues, I put a little Easter egg in each of my books where I tortured Nick. I think it was the third book, I had him. Have you ever seen White Christmas? This is topical for the time this is coming out. Have you ever seen the movie White Christmas with Bing Crosby? So there's a scene there where Rosemary Clooney and I think it's Vera Allen, the Haynes sisters, they do this dance with feather boas, right? They're doing this. And, So I had the two female characters in my book were acting that out in a Christmas party. And so I had Nick do a duet with himself as two women, one of whom was Scottish. So so it was really great and he has really great attention to detail, because I went and we blend the voices together. So they sound like they're tapping at the same time. And I was like, well, how come they're not exactly the same words? He says, well, because they're handing off. I'm like, oh yeah. Like it's a good thing. One of us is paying attention. So that was that one. I had him do a duet with himself as two women. So that was great.
So Nick told us that sometimes authors won't be prepared in terms of like, how do you want them to sound or how do you pronounce a name? Have you been guilty of that at all? Like, has Nick ever come to you and been like, so how do I pronounce this name? And you're like, I don't know. How would you pronounce it?
I would say I'm at both ends of that spectrum horribly. So he's got some, and it's not just him, but a lot of authors, they write the manuscript and then they're done, right? And since I came to writing later in life, after having kids, that my books are like additional kids. And so when I handed off the manuscript, that's the beginning of the work, right? So he and I actually spend a fair bit of time collaborating on every voice. And it's gotten a lot faster over the years because I'm like, it's a little bit like, you know, a little bit like Misha, a little bit like Megan, all these different characters. And then we are able to collaborate really quickly. But so for all of my character names, I know all of the pronunciations. I know how to do all of that. And we do a pronunciation guide at the beginning of each book, just if there's new characters. So I never make him guess on that. However, I am absolutely horrible at geography names and historical names. So I like to do some Forrest Gumpy type things where, if you know from Forrest Gump, where he would be in historical scenes. And we saw that in Trinity's Children, the Dr. Howard character is relating some of his experiences back all the way back to Nazi Germany and so forth. And so there was one of the scientists that unfortunately worked with Dr. Mengele was referenced in the book. And he's like, how do you pronounce that? I'm like, I just write it. It's historically accurate. My work is done. And then with in Trinity's Children, a lot of the Asian names, like the name of the shuttle, the name of the location on the moon where the Chinese went recently onto the dark side of the moon, all of those things, I have no idea. So I have no idea how they're pronounced or anything else. And then in Sentinels, there's a lot of Scotch Gaelic profanity when Shannon, one of the main characters, gets her ire up, and he's like, "How do you pronounce this?" I'm like, "I don't know. I have no idea. It's Scotch Gaelic. I'm Polish, and that's it."
So that's awesome. So you mentioned that you were—I love this phrase—a little late to the game with writing. Like, so you started in your later years. Do you mind sharing just a little bit of like maybe some of your story with that? Whether you know that's your kind of upbringing or how you got into writing and at what stage and kind of what your home life is like a little bit without getting too personal.
Yeah. The scene from Steve Martin and The Jerk just slashed through my head, which probably you can't even say nowadays because half the things are get you canceled. So, I guess at a very early age, I loved stories. My mom, I was really blessed. My mom read to me. She read me Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe was the first book that I remember, that series. And that's actually figures into the Sentinel series in book six, the second to last book. But I really enjoyed stories. And I used to, if you, back in the day, because I'm dating myself, if you had a radio, and you pegged it to right at the edge where the bands met, you could pick up PBS on your radio. So I found and listened to the entirety of Lord of the Rings this was really before audiobooks, but as a performance, right? So it was the full cast, and I listened to that. And I was a really, kind of imaginative kid. One of those ones that just was constantly not paying attention in class most of the time. So I had all these stories in my head and I actually thought that was what everybody was like. And so I could create these worlds and characters and all sorts of different things. And so I did and dabbled with writing, but, wasn't very good, to be perfectly honest. My first book, which will never see the light of day, thank God. And I write this in one of my author's notes, is that there's some authors that are just gifted in terms of being able to imagine a story and then put the words to it. And then there's some that, that have to have kind of life experiences teach them how to do that. And I'm certainly in the latter. I can imagine all sorts of different things, but my writing was very stilted and pretentious when I first started. And you, for me, I needed to live the life experiences that I have of being, you know, a husband and a father, father to one adopted son and two biological kids, one of which has some special needs. All of these things go into the crucible of creating a human being, right? So a lot of those relationships go into my character, and my books are real character driven. So most of the positive feedback that I get is related to kind of the character interplay. And you probably noticed that from how Jay, how that they talk to each other, is that I guess one of the biggest compliments or the best compliments I get is that they feel, these characters feel really real to me. It's like I'm in a room watching them and it almost feels voyeuristic. And that's what I try to create, is this scenario where these people are, you care about them and they feel really real. And these words and these dialogues are things that you could picture yourself saying at a bar with a friend or something else. And I just, I didn't have the skills to do that when I was younger. I had to grow into those, that ability.
That's cool. I totally get what you mean in terms of like, so your characters 100% do sound like real people, especially, you know, there are scenes with Damian Howard and Coleman, and you can instantly tell like these two have a long history together. And that's right off the book. That was what hooked me. And I enjoyed that. And then as you go further, younger Howard, sorry, I don't want to spoil anything, but there's a younger version of Howard that may or may not show up. And he feels like a completely different character too to me. He didn't feel at all like the old one. I would say they weren't even close. So there, I totally am 100%, I can attest to that. Like if you want a book where the characters feel like characters and you can be involved and attached to their lives, this is the book for it. Your book is the book for it.
Yeah. And I appreciate that. It's kind of, there's some people that write amazingly great, detailed, Diana Gabaldon, the Outlander books. My wife loves those books. And she's like, you know, she could write 30 pages on the texture of the stone in a cottage. And you really get the sense of infusing you about the physicality of the area you're in. And then, so my books are kind of like that, but with the characters. So the characters have lots of depth to them. And then they operate in a world that has enough detail to, so that you as the reader or the listener can fill in the gray areas, and make it kind of your own. And I think that's kind of what people really resonates with the stories with them.
I would say it's a satisfying plot that is character driven. Like the story is character driven, but it has a satisfying plot, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's great. It's better than the alternative, right?
Yeah. Some series that are very much plot driven rather than character driven, and they can be okay if the writer is good at it. But even still, I take character driven any day, personally.
Yeah, I would encourage you to take a shot at the Sentinels ones, because it'll be interesting for you. And I don't know, Johnny, did you?
I just started it. I'm excited.
Trinity.
Yeah.
Johnny's okay. Not as fast as me. He wanted to wait till the movie, and I convinced him that he needs to at least get going in this one.
Yeah, I'd like to wait for the movie too. I've got people that send me casting characters. That's really fun. And for the most part, I really like them. And it's awesome because like within the Sentinels one, the main female character is a ginger. And so I have all these really beautiful ginger women coming into my inbox, and my wife's like, oh my God. So she, it gives me license to have all those things flying in there. But I think what you'll find interesting is the contrast between the first book, the first Sentinels book and the first Paradigm book, because the first Paradigm book is written 6 years after the first Sentinels book. So sometimes I cringe a little, and I was on a panel for Dragon Con with a guy that had the best answer for this. He's smarter than me, but he's a doctor, so what do you expect? And I go, you know, when people start my Sentinel series, I always am a little self-conscious, because if in anything you do, you should get better at your craft, whether you're a blacksmith or you're a writer. So when you look at the first Sentinels book and you look at the first Trinity book or the first Paradigm book, the tactic or the technical craft work between the two is significantly different. So things you learn along the way, like an optimal chapter length is really around 2,000 to 3,500 words, you know. And I have a chapter, I think, in the first Sentinels, it's like 7,000 words, you know. and because who knew, right? Yeah. These are things you learn along the way as and how to pace things, and it's less important in audiobooks because people are not as chapter driven as they are in print books. You know, I'm just going to get to one more chapter and I'm going to put it down. Those kinds of things. So I got a lot of feedback that are like, you know, when I say I want to get through one more chapter before I go to sleep, and now it's 4 a.m. So it's a compliment to me that they want to keep going, but they're like, could you make shorter chapters so I can go to sleep?
Or at least have a break in the chapter somewhere, you know, indent it a little there.
Yes, like the florons, yes.
My thing is, I actually have to, a lot of times with my books, I have to kind of stop in the middle of a chapter, because a lot of the authors I read like to have like a cliffhanger at the end of the chapter. And so then I have to start up the next one because I can't end on a cliffhanger. So I like, someone's in the middle of talking and I'm like, ah, you know what, here's a good spot. I just fold the page and call it good.
Yeah, that's good pacing though, to drive someone from one chapter to the next. I must admit I'm a little guilty of that myself sometimes.
Yeah, definitely. I would say you definitely are. Johnny,
I'm gonna praise you though, Robert, because I've been Jay's got me into audiobooks, and that's all I did this summer. Like I always say, Nick was the soundtrack of my summer. And what I really liked about starting yours, and it's something you mentioned, but I didn't realize it till actually listening to it, because I've been listening to Terry Goodwin, all the fantasy that they do. Mm-hmm. Your pace for audio makes so much more sense than this like narrative driven. It's like it's a much easier dialogue, and I really like that about listening to your audiobooks. How do you write for audiobooks, I feel like.
That's actually accurate. So the one thing that I knew when I started the Sentinels books was that I wanted to do audiobooks, partly because of some of the what I mentioned with one of my kids, who has part of his challenges is dyslexia, and has a hard time reading, can't get through a novel. So I wanted to create stories for people that would be able to consume them in whatever format they wanted. So I knew I wanted to go print and ebook and audiobook. It's really interesting when you write for audio first, it's harder, but it makes the print bit better too, because you're much more conscious of the verbal identifiers. So like John said, Jay said, Fred said, you have to write your dialogue so that you don't have all that every time. So you have to have some creative ones. And then if somebody's in a real dense conversation, like within it's with just two people, you can drop those entirely. So then you can just go from one to the other, and then you rely on your voice actor to be able to make sure that the listener is able to keep track of who it is that they're talking to. I got myself into big trouble in one of the Sentinels books because the Shannon character, the Ginger, she was going, there was some timey-wimey stuff, and she ended up meeting herself at a younger age, which was okay when she was meeting herself at, she was 32 and she was meeting a 14-year-old. But then when she's meeting herself at 27, I was like, uh-oh. because I was like 3/4 of the way through the book, and then I realized, how's Nick going to do this? So I just texted him and I was like, hey, by the way, start thinking about how you're going to differentiate between Shannon at 27 and Shannon at 33. I'm sure you'll figure it out.
That's a quick side note. That's really cool about the audiobooks, because I suffer from dyslexia as well. And we had another author, and it helped him because he was a lawyer, and it helped him take tests, audiobooks, and learning how to pay attention. And I was like, that is something that I've never liked reading, but now I can't take enough of it. So it's really cool that you understand and you get it from that perspective of making it for us. So I appreciate that.
Absolutely. I think stories are the most amazing thing. One of the things I don't like about some of the content that's being produced by big studios now is that it's like they have a message they want to deliver, but they deliver it without any subtlety. Like, here's the message I want, and then here's a big hammer in which I will crush your skull until you go, I got it. I get the message you're trying to get me to hear. But I think that most authors have a message too. And embedded in my stories, every one of them has kind of a thematic, a moral thematic to it. But I try to be really subtle with it, to the point where people ask me, like, hey, did you mean for this? And sometimes they see things that aren't there, but most times it's they're unraveling that very kind of slender thread that I've tried to put in there, because there's a message that I want people to be able to consume. And then that gets back to the Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Now C.S. Lewis was his thread was a Christian thread, and it was pretty specific, right? So, but even that was more subtle than you know, some of the big studios are being now. But that allegorical stuff where, you know, people represent things and locations represent things, I think that creates a real, you know, kind of rich tapestry to weave together a story.
I totally get what you mean. Just as a quick aside, there was a scene in the newest Captain Marvel movie where the song I'm Just a Girl plays in like the final battle. And I was like, do you guys have to hit it like so hard over the head? Like, it kind of pulls me out of the movie to make this statement so over the top. And then if you contrast that with Wonder Woman, when they say it's no man's land, no one's getting across this, she says, well, I'm going to get across it. I was really grateful that she didn't say, I'm not a man, and then started walking across it, because that would have, again, pulled me out of the movie. But instead, I really enjoyed that scene where Wonder Woman crosses no man's land. So I know what you mean by that. I appreciate that you don't hit us over the head with a sledgehammer in order to get your points across.
Yeah, I think that's a great contrast, the Captain Marvel and the Wonder Woman, which Wonder Woman is just a great movie. Not to mention that Gal Gadot is absolutely gorgeous. She's the only female actress that is 100% crushed on by all the people in my family, including my wife and daughter. So that's like, there you go. It's like the female equivalent of my kids having to grow up with me with my man crush on Tom Welling as young Superman.
Oh, right there too, Smallville. Yep.
Yeah, there you go. So I liken it, because I'm a big Blade Runner fan, and I try to slip those things in as you've read Trinity, so you know that I got to really expand on that a little bit in Trinity's Children. But have you guys seen that movie, Blade Runner?
Johnny's seen all the movies. I need to catch up on Blade Runner. The first one came out before my time, and the new one came out, and I don't want to watch the new one without seeing the old one, so I'm stuck in this paradox.
So it's funny, because I think I probably have bought that movie like 8 times, because they kept re-releasing new versions. But to tie it to this point was, there's the theatrical release of the movie has this voiceover about what's going on in some real critical scenes. And the director, the director's final cut, and many, every director cut, and then the final cut where he got to do absolutely everything he wanted, doesn't. And it gets back to respecting your audience, right? The theatrical release basically was like, you're too stupid to understand what we're doing, so allow me to put a voiceover track to walk you through everything that's happening. And I happen to think that people are more clever than that. So in my stories, there is no metaphorical voiceover. Those subtle themes are there. If you want to find them, then you can. If you don't, then you can just enjoy a good romp with some fun loving people that get themselves into really obscene situations.
What other? So you love Blade Runner. I know Star Trek comes up in it. I think Star Wars makes a brief appearance, but Star Wars wasn't one that was like hammered. I remember there being references, but it wasn't. It was. I thought Star Trek was more heavily hit. So give us some background into like your nerd universe, you know, growing up and everything. Touched on some, let's hear all of it.
Yeah. So, Johnny Sacco's Flying Robot was my, first love in terms of sci-fi. That was, you know, I'm again dating myself. You guys, this is back what UHF, do you guys even know what UHF is?
Yeah, that's a different channel.
UHF was the you had VHF and you had UHF, and UHF was the VHF was the bunny ear antennas,
right?
And then UHF was like a little disc, and the UHF was for like channel 33 and up, and you could never get UHF to come in right, but UHF was where the good stuff was for the kids, right? So Johnny Sacco's Flying Robot was during that Japanese pre-anime kind of thing. The monsters were all in rubber suits stomping around miniature cities, and the boats all had sparks that shot out as they zoomed across places. And Johnny Sacco's Flying Robot was a flying robot that looked like he had a head of an Egyptian pharaoh. So that's actually referenced in Ready Player One. So which was a great little Easter egg for people in the book, not the movie.
So
the movie.
I was like, movie, where is it in my head?
No, that audiobook was absolutely outstanding, and it's but a lot of it did make it to translation into the movie. Things about Rush, the band Rush, and a bunch of other really cool stuff from the books didn't make it into the movie. But Johnny Sacco's Flying Robot. So that was my first, nerd kind of nerdgasm was that. And that always competed with Ultraman. So you had Ultraman people and good Johnny Sacco people. And I was totally a Johnny Sacco person. And then Star Trek, obviously, Star Trek was brilliant in terms of being able to put those kind of societal issues embedded in there. I mean, you had the first interval kiss, one of my favorite Star Trek movies, which is really formative in some of my writing because I put these moral themes in there. I think it's Jack Gorshin, the guy who played the Joker in the 1960s Batman. So there was a scene, I don't know if you guys are familiar with the Star Trek, but there was a show where the species had a white side of their face and a black side of their face. So let's say that their left side was white and their black side, or their right side was black. There had been civil war forever. And so Kirk and company went in to try to make peace, as I recall, right? And the climax scene is where the Jack Gorshin, or the Gorshin character, is like, how can you expect us to make peace with those people? And Kirk's like, I don't understand. You guys are exactly the same. And he's like, we're not the same at all. He's white on his left side, and I'm white on my right side. And I was like, you know, because obviously, you know, you know what they're going for, right? Like these superficial things are not what should be separating us, and certainly not having us treat each other inhumanely. But by taking the real differences that we have societally and skewing it to the ludicrous, right? Well, it's not just that you're two different colors, right? But it's just which color is on which side, and that's enough to create war, right? So that was really impactful for me too, because my dad was a career Marine, and So we didn't really grow up. It wasn't tolerated in our family to grow up with some of those prejudices, even though we definitely grew up in different areas where some of that took place. But Marines, the only colors my dad used to say was the only colors they see are scarlet, blue, and gold. Those are the only colors that we're allowed to see. So that kind of flows through some of my stories too. Like with Trinity, the publisher was like, "When did you write this?" I said, it's 170,000 words, so it's been a while. But it was published during this past summer, right? When we have the Black Lives Matter and the protests and the riots and all this other kind of stuff with George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and other people, right? And so she's like, "How did you write this so topically?" And I was like, no, I like, this is just my writing. Because for those who are maybe watching this, the main character in Paradigm 2045 is a woman named Charlotte Omandi, and she's a Kenyan woman who becomes thrust into the whirlwind of what the entire plot is about. So I've gotten a lot of questions like, "Did you write this because of 2020?" And I was like, "I can't write that fast, nor am I that smart to do that." So this story was what the story was. Charlotte Omandi appeared to me, which is what happens with my characters, and she was who she was. So I've had people go, "Why is this character gay?" Or, "Why is this character black?" I'm like, because that's who they are, right? That's when they show up, like they literally show up. It's freaky. And that's who they are. And I stay true to what they are when they show up.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's one of the most diverse casts. There's a show called Community where the dean jokes about like how they're a very diverse group of people. And that was a joke I almost wanted to make about the book, because you've got a Scotsman, a Russian, you've got a Kenyan. And then I think you've got two Americans. I know Dr. Howard's American, and then there was one other. I thought, isn't the telepath American? Am I remembering wrong?
No, she's Scandinavian.
Okay. That's right. Sorry. You put so many in, I can't even keep track of it anymore.
No, and it's fair because she doesn't have a Scandinavian accent.
Right.
So she has kind of a nondescript American accent because it was distracting when we ended up doing the voice analysis with all the different characters talking to each other. I ended up pulling the Scandinavian accent from the initial, when we did the initial voice test.
Got it. Yeah. That's cool. I thought that, cause I was like, I don't remember her having an accent, but I do know that she can tweak accents in the book. She can do whatever accent she wants.
Right. One of her genetic enhancements is to be able to translate languages at the phoneme level. So all languages are predicated on like 64, I think, phonemes. And then those are just reorganized in different ways for every language. So that's, she's like a walking babblefish from Hitchhiker's Guide. So you were asking about influences. So Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, Doctor Who was a huge influence for me. Doctor Who is all throughout the Sentinel series as an homage to him. My doctor was the fourth doctor, Tom Baker with the scarf. And I've gotten my kids and wife all into the reboot from 2005. And we hotly debate whether or not David Tennant or Matt Smith are the best doctor.
I always lean towards David. That's me. Matt Smith took a while to get me to love him. I love David right off the bat. That's how I settle the arguments when I get into it.
Well, that's true. And because, you know, if you were like us, when David Tennant regenerated into Matt Smith, my son captured it perfectly. He goes, "Matt Smith can suck it."
Exactly. That's how I felt too. I'm with him on that. Second that.
Right. So he had to overcome all that.
I guess that's right. To win your hearts.
Whereas with the ninth doctor going into David Tennant, I'm like, "What? You just got here. What are you doing, dude?" And you can't regenerate after one season. So I was pissed at him. So I was predisposed to liking David, and then, you know, obviously he just inhabited that character wonderfully. For you, Jason, you'd be starting it sooner than Johnny. The second Sentinels book has a very strong tie-in between Lucifer and Doctor Who, which you would say, how does that work? It's fun. So.
I won't say what my guess is, but I feel like I have a guess on that.
I think you'd be wrong, but I'll tell you what, I'll bet you a dollar that you're wrong.
That sounds good. I probably am.
How much drugs were you taking when you wrote that chapter?
So I don't. So this is a nerd fashion for me. I haven't watched a ton of Doctor Who. I know what the storylines are, and I know who the Doctors are, but I haven't sat down and watched through it all. Mostly because it's such a big commitment that I'm like, I don't know if I want to get pulled into that wormhole. Like that's almost
these aren't long chapters, Jay. They're like 8 episodes long. Come on.
Yeah, but there's like 47 seasons, Johnny.
Just watch 2005 to now, and you'll be fine.
Okay, I'll do that. How's that?
If you watch Blink, you'll never go back. That's what I do with people that I want to torture. I'm like, just watch one. Just watch Blink. And then they watch that and they're like, okay, now I have to go back and watch them all.
I still get terrified. I joke. We play Dungeons and Dragons, and to this day we still get nervous by like the Weeping Angels. Like we're just like, Doctor Who has a lot of stuff that can scare you. It's not just for kids.
Oh, it's great. So it filed under bad parenting, we had this angel in our front yard, like a stone angel. And after the Doctor Who, such bad parents,
I
took the
it.
Statue and we moved it into the hallway. And so one of the kids, she came out of the bathroom and she's like, ah! and that was, I mean, we tried to say we were balancing it out because after the movie The Ring came out, if you guys ever saw that, my daughter was young, and we had her wet her hair and put it over her head, and then she walked into her older brother's room like that. So then he shrieked. So we were like, well, we did that to him, so we had to do something to you because there's no more kids.
You're turning the children against themselves. That's amazing.
I will do. I haven't gotten too far, but I've felt a little bit of Battlestar in it. Galactica, maybe, because it's like,
it's in there.
That the first few seasons of that still get me crying. So I just, when I was listening to it, I was like, wait a minute, I'm feeling a little Adama running around. I feel a little inspiration going through.
Yeah, that's a great catch. In fact, if you look at the uniforms, my daughter created the uniforms for the cover and that are referenced. And the uniforms are a mashup of Next Generation, The Expanse, and Battlestar. So she took one segment from each of them, and then she loves drawing and fashion, and so she created the uniforms out of elements from all of those. And so yeah, the one of the reviews of it was if Battlestar Galactica, The Expanse, and Blade Runner had a baby, it would be this book.
And it's Battlestar where everyone's called Sir, right? That was one element you threw into there, Sir.
Yeah.
Sir?
Yes, so Battlestar was the first one that did that, and then The Expanse picked that up, that thread as well. In the Paradigm book, it's you know it already, but it's called out, and the reason why it makes sense is the patriarch of the series, if you will, Dr. Howard, a long-lived 175-year-old person, he loved those things. So, and he's a trillionaire and he's can do whatever he wants for the most part, except live forever. So he was basically like, I like Battlestar Galactica and I don't really want to have these kinds of, these gender issues. So we're just going to all call each other the same thing. And then some of the other characters are like, well, that's stupid. He's like, too bad. So from the author perspective, I don't have to take a position as to whether it's good or bad, because I could put that on Howard's shoulders. He did it.
Right. And he's putting it on Battlestar Galactica's shoulders.
So, exactly.
I mean, you've gotten that so far away from yourself.
I have so much plausible deniability that I'm good. And I, as long as I don't mention it on Twitter, where we're then, that matters.
So real quick, before we, so we're starting to jump really into Paradigm. Would it be okay if we just did a quick, like, this is what the book is about. We're going to give you a quick, you know, for the people who haven't read it, this is a, like an intro or a
little sneak peek. So, Paradigm 2045 is based in the year 2045. And the premise is that, in 1945, we split the atom, and that, that made us a species of interest, because there was other civilizations out there that determined that once a species is capable of splitting the atom, they're capable of making trouble. So they developed over the years a set of criteria that a species needs to pass as kind of like hurdles. That they would become good members of a galactic community, and they had 100 years to pass that up, or if they didn't, then they got exterminated. So the for the good of the galaxy, and so the book taking place in the last 6 months or so before this grace period ends, and covers the story of how humanity will either pass those tests or not, and it tees up the moral challenge of do the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the one through the rest of the series, where it unfolds whether or not that really was their motivation, was for the good of the galaxy, or did they have a darker motivation, which I tease in the first book but is really explored in the second. And then the ramifications of that are fully revealed in the third book. So that's kind of the big arc. And there's some little heroic journeys in there in the first book when they have first contact. It's with a member of one of this civilization species that doesn't agree that it's a moral good to exterminate a race, even if they pose a threat, because they haven't done it yet. So it's kind of a little bit of Minority Report there, right? Can you convict someone based on what they are likely to do versus what they have done? And that's explored as well. Did that do a pretty good job? You read it, so
yeah. No. So humanity has to reach some criteria. One of them, and this was my favorite one, was they have to create a ship that can go faster than the speed of light. And the reason I like that one so much, so the way it all kind of starts is they find an alien shuttle, and then an avatar shows up and explains this to them, like, hey, you're on the chopping block, so chop chop, Dr. Howard, who's the really old and genius character who kind of sets everything into motion. I don't know if this came from D&D or not, but the alien species reminded me of Dragonborns. I don't know if you've played any D&D or not.
Oh, yeah. I actually was D&D when Gary Gygax version 1. It was the criteria for being able to play D&D in school was you had to be willing to go into the, quote, gifted program, which was ludicrous for me anyway. But I was like, so I get to play D&D if I'm in the gifted program? What is this gifted program, and what must I do? Well, you're going to have to do good in math. Damn it. All right. It's worth it. So, yeah, I played D&D a lot. They have a little bit of Dragonborn. They have a little bit of the Elder Scrolls race, Beams of an Eye, Ithrix or something like that. And I think Nick does a great job of elongating the S's for those characters. He does a great job in acting as the Drakath is the name of the species in the book, and he does a great job of that.
My favorite part of it is they find the avatar, and they don't know if it's listening to them or not. And Dr. Howard is like, oh, if we need to do some biological experimenting, I can take over or whatever. Like, he was kind of being a little Freudian, a little subtle there. And I lost it. I thought that was so funny, that line. And then there's one other where she asks him, like, have you reached light speed yet? And he says, no, I'm a little short on warp drives at the moment. Like, come on, lady. Like, what are you talking about?
Right.
So funny.
Right. So. Yeah, and that and I try to weave humor in every one of my books because I think it's a great counterbalance to some of the more serious themes. And one of the funniest things that, because I have to listen to my own books when I'm prepared to the next book, right? And I find myself like an idiot, like if I'm listening in the car where I laugh at my own jokes, it's very meta, and I'm like, that's really funny. And the way your minds work is you don't remember stuff from, if we remembered everything we did 3 years ago, we'd never get out of bed. So I listen to a book I wrote 6 years ago and a scene comes up that I don't remember at all. And then something happens and I start laughing and I have to look around and make sure no one sees me because I feel like an idiot laughing at my own jokes.
That's funny because we'll have like our friends listen to this and sometimes our posts are a little delayed and I just forget. They'll be like, that was so funny. And I start laughing like, Johnny, you said that. We're repeating you. I'm like, oh, all right, cool. I'm glad I said it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
I was gonna say that Damian Howard is my favorite character. To me, he's introduced right at the beginning, and he just kind of feels like some dude who just came from a safari. Like, he almost reminds me of, like, a Teddy Roosevelt, or I don't even know what, which I don't think that's necessarily how you meant to present him, but it's just how I started to picture him in my head. Like, he's just off the cuff, like, haha, I can do this, and he's gonna jump off a cliff, and he's one of those characters that's just, like, dude has got a super red personality to me, super go-getter, and I don't have a red personality at all. I've got a very, like, on the color spectrum of personalities, I'm very blue. So sometimes I attach to those characters because they're, like, who I wish I was at times. So I really attached to Howard, and he cracked me up throughout the series, both in all the versions that you may or may not see of him.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that because he's definitely somebody that, like you say, a blue person can live vicariously through him. One of the most, you know, I get different kinds of reviews. I get reviews that are just like, you know, wow, this is great fun. And then I have people that like peel it back and they try to look for all that internal stuff. Sometimes they see more than I even put there. But with Damian, his arc from the beginning to the last scene between him and Omandi when he's going to Earth and he places himself under her command. He's the one that created all of this, but he is under her authority and she sends him, off on a mission. And he looks at her and tells her what she means to him. Because he starts off, you know, and he's brusque and he's got a focus and he has dark humor, but he isn't necessarily warm and fuzzy.
No.
Right? But that last scene with Charlotte where he really is vulnerable, and because she's like a daughter to him, which again was important to me because that contrast of races, right? So he views her as his daughter, the daughter he never had, despite her being from Kenya and him being from Britain. Because it doesn't matter to them, right? There are so many other things that they have to work through. Because literally, the species, our species, is at threat.
Yeah, we don't want to take up all your time, so we're going to start to get towards the ending here.
Not sure.
But I am really looking forward to book two. I thought now that, you know, you do a really good job of introducing the characters and you get to know them. And I feel like now that I've got all these characters in my head and I've got them fleshed out, I'm excited to see like how it's going to go in terms of now that they, you know, you don't have to spend time developing them. They can just be witty and they can just go crazy and I get to see how they react and I get to enjoy it. And I'm excited for that. If that makes sense. Like the due diligence period is over for these characters.
Right.
So I'm excited for book two.
First books. I wrote about this one of my author's notes. I've decided I hate first books because it's so much work trying to figure out who these people are. But then And I think Sentinels is a great example because, I put it in the author's note, which makes me sound a little insane, which is fine. but starting in book three of the Sentinels series, I picture scenes. I know these different things are going to happen. And I basically put the people in there and I take notes on what they do. And that's the dialogue. That's the story. Because I know them well enough and they know how they're going to react that if I know and I put them in this environment, they're going to do something. I don't necessarily know what it's going to be. So when I talk about being an outline and a hybrid outline discovery writer, so outline authors, they outline everything and then they follow their outline. And it's just nothing wrong with that. Discovery authors don't know really anything and they're just kind of writing as it unfolds. So I have a really rough outline. So I know there's going to be these kinds of scenes, but I don't really know what's going to happen within them. And then the characters go into the scene and then they are who they are. So it's like for you in Trinity, if I were to put, you know, James and Misha in a room, you know, James is not going to start talking about, you know, thermodynamics, or the fine points of navigation. You know, if someone was like, well, how are you going to get from point A to point B? He's like, it'll work out, you know, because I'm awesome.
Yeah.
John Crichton approach. I love it.
Yeah. And conversely, if it was Dr. Carpenter, you know, in a room and someone did something horrible, he would be like, well, no, let's not overreact. I agree that he just said something really hateful to you, but maybe he was having a bad day, you know? And that's what but you don't know that in the first book. You don't know who these people are. With the second Trinity's book, the challenge that I'm having is that you're not going to take a starship X number of light years, which was a pain to try to figure out how far they're going. with a crew of nine people, right? Because they're all almost kind of archetypical, right? You have one doctor, you have one navigator, you have one engineer. Like if you lose any of them, mm-hmm. you know, you're screwed, right? So you got to have a backup. So in the last chapter of Trinity, they're talking about how they're gonna assemble the crew for this next stage, the second book, Humanity's Promise. So they add 60 people to this ship. Now I'm not going to flesh out 60 people plus the original 10 because that would be insane. The only good part about that would be to try to watch Nick juggle it. But but you have to take another set of people, and they need to be secondary characters that you care about that aren't red shirts, you know, but that don't take away from the primacy of the first characters. Because those are our crew, right? Those are the ones that the listeners are kind of invested in. So that's kind of been the challenge of adding really another 10 people to the mix, so they can pop in and pop out and have their own kind of unique characteristics, but they're kind of supplementary. You know, it's an extra doctor, it's an extra navigator, but they all have to have some screen time so you care.
I love that. Hey, so I kind of want to start wrapping up, but I had one last question for you. As an inspiring writer, how do you make things so frustrating sometimes? I want to say this with context. In this series of the books, the governments of the world are the most frustrating thing I've ever had to get through. And I mean that in a positive way. Like, it pulled me in so much. How did that even come to you, to have, you know, the governments just stepping on people's toes and just pulling crap? Like, where did that come from? Where did that inspiration come from? Because I thought that was one of the coolest plot points that I don't see a lot that pulled me in, to have kind of this, like, I don't know, people just mucking up the situation, you know? Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, that gets to the point I raised earlier about life experiences. You know, I think that by the time you get to be 50, you know, and I'm over 50, and you've raised kids, you've gone through so many interactions with governmental entities and corporate entities. So it's like wherever people are gathered, they seek out power some personality types seek out power. And I've often said the best qualifying trait for someone to be president of the United States is that they don't want to be president of the United States, you know, because the people that seek these roles probably shouldn't have them for a lot of times, because they tend to either at the beginning or get corrupted. And I don't mean like corruption, but they get the original thought gets corrupted, and they start to think that they know best. And then that gets multiplied by nations. So the point you're raising is like, all right, so if these people are not successive, everybody dies, right? But the governments are like, yeah, but they should be doing it my way. Right.
Oh, yeah.
And then you have two competing governments that are like, well, no, they should do it. They should. We can't let the Chinese help them not get us killed. We have to be the ones that help us not get killed, even if our conflict results in us getting killed.
They have a warp drive. I want that.
That's right. Yeah. So it's really just that. It's just the human condition that, that some personality types, you know, like the colors, right? The red colors tend to seek out power. And then, you know, then you have the bluer people that are just like, I'm sure it'll be fine. They're probably good people. And then you have the people in the middle that are like, how did I end up with this? You know, some of these rules are just dumb. Or some of the motivations that people have, for doing certain things are just dumb. So that adds kind of some of that reality. I think it also gives the listener the ability to vent a little. They're like, yeah, you know what? That these people are annoying. and they can do that in the course of their entertainment, as opposed to having to like watch Fox News or CNN, where it's like, I want people to be able to escape from this constant droning, right? But you can't ignore it. So you can create fun at it, and then your team being able to continually get past them, you know, we're going to drop this roadblock. Well, I'll go around it, you mm-hmm. know. It allows you to identify with that team and go, yeah, you know, my team is going to show these dummies that we're going to succeed despite them.
Yeah, I love that. I don't have any final notes. Johnny, do you have any final notes?
No, I just I was going to ask a long time ago, because I have a hard time like listening to our podcast. I was wondering if you listen to your books when Nick does it, but you already answered that, which is great that you have to listen through Nick.
Yep. I listen to it every chapter. He sends me a chapter, I listen to it, and then I give him feedback. And then when I'm prepping for the next book in the series, like I'm going to start book 7, the last book in the Sentinel series, probably in about 4 months, once Humanity's Promise, the second paradigm book, is done, or to beta. When it goes to beta, mm-hmm. then I'll start on the Sentinels. So I got to listen to all of those Sentinels books so that I'm up to speed, because while, you know, I'm certainly no J.K. Rowling, enough people have started listening and reading these books that I've gotten like continuity challenges. Like, hey, this happened in book 1, but now in book 6 you said this. I think you screwed up. So I'm like, I probably did. So I've got some folks that are like actually paying attention. So I really don't want to pull them out of the story by making stupid mistakes. I just want to make smart, very clever mistakes. So I actually have to pay a lot of attention, because at 6 books in, you know, you're looking at like 800,000 words, you know, that you have to get through, which is like one George R.R. Martin novel, I know, but still for me, it's a lot.
Well, and that takes, having it be separate books takes a lot of revision, because each book, you're not going to do that revision all at once. It's going to be, this book needed 6 rewrites or whatever. So,
yeah, it goes through, an initial draft, one revised draft, an alpha reading, which is a very, very small group of people who are sadists, and they're very mean to me. and then it goes, it's revised based on alpha. Then I print the books and send them out to about 5 different beta readers. Then I get all the beta feedback, and then I go through, and then I send it finally to a copy editor, at the end. So it goes through, you know, a series of refinements, which is really good. Cause I've had some real clunkers in ideas that my alpha readers have been like, that can never happen.
So, I love that.
It's awesome.
Yeah. They're mean. They're very mean people. And I put that in I hid that reference, in the print book, where I mentioned my alpha readers and I thank them for their sadistic tendencies and complete lack of humanity.
I don't think I caught that I don't think it's on the Audible edition. Maybe I didn't catch it, but that's awesome.
No, Podium was not excited about having Nick read that. So that got cut.
Awesome. Johnny, any final thoughts? Do you have any shameless plugs for us,
Ross? Yeah, we're going to say, where can we find all of Robert Ross's, all your stuff, all online, all on Amazon?
Yeah, so all of the print and ebooks are available on Amazon. The audiobooks are available on Amazon and Audible. My website, you can get to it either by robertwross.com or spartamac.com, spartamac.com. That's my publishing company. If you leave a review for all my books, then you get unlimited access to all high-res art and 2 unreleased audiobooks. I really appreciate the time it takes for people to do those reviews. And it's so important for people to find good stories as well as avoid them. And it sounds counterintuitive, but you know, money's tight. And the last thing I want is someone who's not going to dig one of my books to pick it up, because they're not going to enjoy it. I'm not going to enjoy the review they leave if they leave one. So really thoughtful reviews take time. And that's why I want to give back, what I can, which is the art and the unreleased audiobook, which is actually a novella that ties together the world of Paradigm and the world of Sentinels. So it's a really interesting little Easter egg that ties those two worlds together.
Very nice. Well, I'll be downloading some new books this weekend.
Yeah.
Yeah. The 6th Sentinels book is going to be out in January. And then the 2nd Paradigm book, is due to be out at the end of August if everything goes well. So that's, those two are going to be out in 2021.
Very nice.
But I'm jealous of you, Jay. You are actually both you guys, because you've got all those books ahead of you. One of my favorite things is finding a series or an author that I like, and there being a bunch of books, because then I can just I can go from one to the other. And one of the things I promised folks is that they would get each book, God willing, unless something happened to me, every year they'd get a story, and that's my commitment to them. Because it's really frustrating when you're so invested in a character or an author or a story, and then they, like, it's been 2 years, 3 years, whatever. And as a fan as well as an author, when I wrote A Power Renewed, I didn't know it was going to be a series, because until the market says that you're not a crappy writer, you don't know, right? Until 10,000 people read your books and go, this is pretty good, right? So I've got that. So I've got tens of thousands of people that have read that book, and they're like, this is pretty good. So then if you're going to write a series, because I'm a fan as well as an author, I was like, I'm not going to write this series unless I can commit to at least one book a year. Because I don't want people to get frustrated with me or the characters. So that's why, each year there's been a Sentinels book, and each year there'll be a Paradigm book. And then there's also an ending. So sometimes I think authors don't end a series when they should. And I run into a number of them as I've met them over the years. And I'm like, one of the things I said to the 3 different authors who've got series that have gone longer than 7 books, I said, you know, it seems like you're angry with your characters. And they go, I'm not angry. I'm frustrated, because I want to do a new series and my fans won't let me, because every time I start a new series, they're like, well, yeah, but what about that one? So that's when I decided that Sentinels was going to be 7 books and done. Trinity would be three and done. And it gives you, it empowers you as an author, like you have to get your story done, right? It's not going to continue to stretch forever. And then you can move on to something else, whether it's spinoff books that you revisit the characters or you don't, right? But you've got that definitive beginning, middle, and end. It also allows you to create some really interesting arcs, like with the Sentinels, it's three up, a peak, three down. So you're able to do, like I did a really very specific cliffhangery thing at the end of book four in that series. And you don't want to, at least I don't want to do a lot of cliffhangers, because I think that it really is, it's not fun for a reader to have to wait a year to have something resolved. So I knew in that series there'd be one. And then for people that have waited till five books are printed or shortly six, they don't have to wait, right? But I won't be doing another one. So it's not like there's only one cliffhanger for that whole series.
Awesome. We would love to send you some stickers, whether or not you use them or your children. We'd love to send you some. We've got a bunch of different custom decals we send. Eventually, when we have a huge shipment of shirts, we'll send you one. Do you have any shirts you want to shamelessly plug, or any merch or anything that you want people to check out?
Yeah, sure. I got, you know, these. This is one of the characters from Sentinels of Creation. You can get to that merchandise from spartamac.com. There's a tag there. For the most part, I use a company called Pixels that does all my merch, because they unlike a different company that's related to a color and a bubbly thing, I can make them affordable, because you can set how much money you as the author want to make, and I set it really, really, really low, because for people that love the story and they want to wear this stuff, I don't want to make a bunch of money off of them. I just want you to be able to get a nice shirt or a phone case or whatever. So spartamac.com, there's a physical merch button, and then you can go in there and buy a Trinity's Children shower curtain, which they actually have. I'm like, all right, cool.
I just purchased at home, so maybe that'll be the one that we will put up there.
There you go. Can have all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
All right, cool.
So yeah, I would love to have, you know, stickers and stuff. I'd be happy to when I go to conventions and stuff, be happy to bring them.
I was going to say I'm excited, because our new thing now is to meet amazing people like you and authors and get their books and then meet you guys at cons and have you sign it. So we're looking forward to when the world lets us have conventions again.
Yeah, I hope so. I'm booked at Liberty Con, which is in Chattanooga, and Dragon Con, as an attending pro at both of those. And obviously Dragon Con is next Labor Day. So God willing, we'll all be able to gather again, at that time. But I would love to see you guys there.
Yeah, Dragon Con is one that we're trying to get ourselves into. So we'll see if it happens. We're a little more out west. FanX is in Salt Lake, and that's a pretty big one. And we're going to try and – so we have some friends on the board there, and we're going to see if we can get them to convince, you know, some of our friends that we've interviewed to be flown out to come check out FanX. I think it's top five in the – San Diego Comic-Con and New York are the top two. And then I think FanX falls in the top five for nerd conventions, like Comic-Con conventions. So pretty big. So yeah. If we can get you out, we'll try and do it. We'll try and shamelessly get you out as much as we can.
All right. Fair enough. I was out that way 20 years ago. I had a really good time. So, it's a long time ago. But I liked it. It was fun. Good people.
Yeah, well, and we'll try head your way too. We're trying to get ourselves nationwide. We'll see if it happens. It's hard during a pandemic somehow. It's hard to get. So yeah, I don't know.
I know. Go figure. Yeah.
we're just getting miles, getting points now, accumulating points and saving it.
Gotcha.
We dub people that are awesome enough to come, because our fans are knights, and then if our names are part of our podcast. Jay's the master of death. I'm the master of light. And then if you're cool enough to be on our cast, we W the master of something. Jay, did we sort out what we want to give Robert here?
Space.
Just not baiting. Just don't. Yeah. Not
master of, we'll call you the master of space, because you know more about as much about sci-fi as I do, and I can never get Jay to watch any of these shows. So glad to have someone on who knew, actually knew what Next Gen meant. So that was a...
TNG.
Yeah, there you go. So we'd like to thank Robert, the master of space. Amazing Ooh. Author, for spending some time with us.
Thank you, guys. Love doing it. And happy to, you know, to revisit another time. I'm sure you guys are going to be wonderfully successful. And look forward to watching you guys do great things and seeing you on the convention circuit.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to hear.
Yeah, we'll have you back on when Trinity 2, that's not what, Paradigm, when your second book in the Paradigm series comes out. I don't think it'll be called Trinity 2.
And we'll do our own panel. We'll get Nick to come back on and we'll just panel.
That'd be great.
Couple of nerdy friends going at it.
Yeah, that would be awesome. Because we definitely tend to light each other up when we're Perfect. On the same panel.
All right, nice. We will see you on the flippity flop.
Flippity flop.